Archbishop Rowan Williams, it's been a historic day for you, welcoming the first Pope ever to Lambeth Palace, then praying together here at the tomb of Edward the Confessor in Westminster Abbey. Can you share, first of all, your impressions with us, and perhaps also tell us anything about that private meeting that you had together?
I think the main thing I'd want to say is that it's been an enormously happy day, and the Pope clearly has felt happy and at home here. I know that his visits to school and the presidential home have been wonderful occasions, and the reception that he's had from the bishops, from the public in the streets, and also, of course, in Westminster Hall, the reception has been hugely positive, and certainly evening prayer at the Abbey was intensely moving for everybody who was there.
It exceeded most expectations, didn't it?
I think one of the nice things about today has been, and yesterday, has been the sense of so many predictions being proved wrong. The sense that this has been an occasion greatly blessed, and that people have, so to speak, come out onto the streets in favour of faith.
Can you tell us anything about that private meeting in Lambeth Palace? Did you discuss any of those difficult issues that the Pope said he wasn't going to talk about in public?
Those are issues that get discussed routinely in our formal dialogues. And I think it's a shame if we spend private time just talking about the difficulties. So we talked a bit about the Holy Land and Christians in the Holy Land, with an eye, of course, to the forthcoming Synod on the Middle East. We talked a bit about some of the great areas of conflict where we're trying to work together. We both have some knowledge of this. We spoke about how the Anglican and Roman Catholic hierarchies in Sudan have worked together in witness and peacemaking, and how urgent it is that that be strengthened. And we spoke about the subject which both of us have mentioned today, which the Holy Father's talked about a great deal, and that is how to engage in a rational dialogue with secularism.
Yes, you both talk very much about the need for closer cooperation and witness, don't you, in this increasingly secular world. And yet the public perception remains, really, of such deep divisions between the churches and contrasting viewpoints. It's very worrying. It must be very worrying for you.
It is. Conflict always makes a better headline story than harmony, I realise. But as many people have said to me just this evening, when you think of how utterly unimaginable this would have been 40, 50 years ago, even as the Second Vatican Council was beginning, clearly something has happened. And part of that something is a return to the roots, something about which the Pope and I again spoke privately. Some of our theological enthusiasms in common there, the heritage of the fathers, and actually again, praying together at the shrine of Edward the Confessor, looking back to that age when the boundaries were not what they are now between Christians. All of that is, I think, part of a very positive picture. And I think it's a pity that the world only sees the quarrels. It's as if that tiny 6 inches above the surface is what matters, and the immense weight of routine prayer, understanding, and just love and friendship goes unnoticed.
If we look back to Pope John Paul's visit in 1982, of course, the first pope since the Reformation to come over here to England, that was seen as a huge step towards reconciliation. What do you hope might be the lasting impact, perhaps, of this visit?
All along, part of my prayer and hope for this visit has been that it will help to put faith on the map in this country and help to make people recognise that huge numbers of perfectly ordinary people believe in God, believe in the sacramental life of the Church and ground their lives on that, and that's not something marginal or bizarre. And I think there's been something of that. But I would also hope that in terms of our mutual relations, of course, there's the next round, we hope, of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission. But also the talk that we had about common witness in development, in care for the poor, and not least, of course, Christian minorities. I hope to strengthen that.
You talk there, of course, of the next round of ARCHIC, which is beginning next year. It'll be exploring issues around authority in the churches. At the recent Synod of the Church of England, you proposed those changes to draft legislation on women bishops, telling people to vote according to their conscience. And yet you lost that vote, and some obviously saw it as a crisis of confidence in your leadership. What's your reaction to that, and how do you explain this style of authority to perhaps a Catholic audience?
A bishop, an archbishop, and I guess even a pope isn't a party political leader constantly driving votes to shore up, you know, crumbling confidence or security. A pastor is always attempting both to gauge the feeling of the Christian family and to lead it forward. So in terms of our synodical system, I think that's part of what the Archbishop of York and I were trying to do. Sense where the Church actually wanted to be. And make no mistake, I think the Church of England does want to make generous provision for minorities. Sense where the Church wants to be, and then say, and now this is a way which might change the terms a bit and take us forward. Now, that didn't win quite the level of approval that the Archbishop of York and I hoped for. That being said, it revealed that willingness to make things work for the minority was still there. It's given us a bit of a mandate to go on thinking and praying about it. So I don't feel that the fact that you don't simply impose authority from the top, in the Church of England, that you seek to move things forward gently in that way. I don't think that's a lack of authority. I think it's trying to make it work in a humane fashion.
This question of women's ordination to the episcopacy is one of the greatest stumbling blocks still, though, isn't it? What hopes do you have for this, for being able to find a way through this?
In the short term, it's obviously very difficult to see how we'll find easy common ground. But that being said, of course, we have common ground. And this is something I've underlined quite a lot in the Church of England recently. We have the early Anglican Roman Catholic agreed statements on ministry. We have a common language for talking about these things. And as I suppose I was trying to say in a lecture in Rome last year, I would like to see us work hard at that common ground and try and understand better why we seem to reach such different conclusions, even starting from that common ground. So plenty to do there.
The tensions between the call of conscience and obedience to authority is also at the heart of John Henry Newman's story, both as an Anglican and as a Catholic. I know you're a great admirer of Newman, but how do you feel about his beatification and the difficulties that this presents for some Anglicans?
Well, I think the surprising thing is how few Anglicans I meet who really do seem to have difficulties about it. Everyone is talking about the difficulties. But I can honestly say that nobody in the last year or two has come up to me and said, I have great difficulties about the beatification of John Henry Newman. I think people have slightly different views about his legacy, obviously. And it won't surprise anyone that people have different views about whether he was right to do what he did in 1845. But Newman is genuinely part of a common heritage. The work that Newman did as an Anglican before he was received into the Roman Catholic Church was significant for Anglican theology as well as Roman Catholic theology. And what perhaps is less often said, the greatest work of his maturity, the Grammar of Assent, was in large part shaped by his absorption of Anglican religious philosophy of the 18th century. So I don't feel there's any need for tribal wars over Newman.
Coming back to the present day and one of the most recent difficulties that have emerged between the two communions, the surprise announcement by the Vatican of the Ordinariate for disaffected Anglicans stands out as one of the most tense moments over this past year. How has that affected your work, and what kind of conversations have you had with Anglicans about it?
A relatively small number of people in the Church of England have wanted to explore this. I hadn't ever expected it to be a huge number, because I think that if Anglicans of a Catholic tradition want to become Roman Catholics, probably the majority would want to do it in what you might call the ordinary way rather than the ordinariate way. So, yes, plenty of conversations. Of course, difficult conversations with people really struggling with their future and their conscience, and whether they take the ordinariate option or another one, obviously an uncertain future, a profound change of gear in ministry and in the assumptions you bring to ministry, an uprooting. It may not be quite as traumatic as it was for Newman, but it's still a really serious matter. So a lot of pastoral conversation there, and also a lot of very helpful and constructive discussion with our brethren in the Roman Catholic hierarchy in this country as to how to monitor this and help it happen where it needs to happen without too many tears.
But it's not the difficulty, perhaps, that it's being painted in the media, for example.
Once again, a huge story of conflict, tanks on the lawn and all the rest of it, which I must say I thought at the time, and think even more now, was preposterous. Here was a pastoral proposal, which certainly we'd have liked to be more involved in discussing. I made no secret of that. But not an aggressive act, but an act which attempted to say, well, we recognise there are these conscientious difficulties. This is what we would want to do to help. And conversations with our partners in Rome, our ecumenical partners in Rome, have certainly not been overshadowed by this.
Finally, any plans then for a return to the Vatican in the near future?
I'm hoping that I may be able to attend a conference before the end of this year to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. And that will give me a chance to catch up with theological friends in Rome and do a bit more exploration with them.
Thank you very much indeed.